The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Listen, we have to wait because we're a small group a little while. So let's go in here and we're gonna talk a little. Yeah, wasn't that enjoyable? It's actually a portal. Come grab a seat and we'll do a little talking. We have about 20 minutes till the cable car leaves, because it leaves on the half an hour. So, funny, I haven't bought, I'm actually enjoying having such a small group. It's nice, we can stick together. So what I'll do is, I'll give you a little background sort of along the way. There are a number of questions. Between the years 68 and 70, the Great Revolt in all of Israel, mostly in the north, from Jerusalem northwards, along the sea coast, along the Jordan Valley, hundreds of thousands of Jews are murdered, millions of Jews are displaced. In Jerusalem alone, you remember I told you 100,000 Jews were killed in a month, 120,000 Jews were sold into slavery. During that period of time, small groups succeed in escaping and making their way down to the desert. Some of them join the Essenes, and some of them know that there's a Roman garrison that is sitting on top of a fortress that was built, actually originally populated by the Maccabees, and built into a fortress by King Herod. Now, just to give you a historical perspective, okay? The Maccabees revolted against Greece, which at that time was the big bully on the block. Alexander the Great conquered the known world. By the time he was 16 years old, he died well before he was 30. He was a very impressive fellow. When he died, his dream of greater Greece fell apart. He had two generals, Seleucid and Ptolemy, and they basically split up his empire, and the splits continued on. So there was an Assyrian Greek contingent, which by 168 before the Common Era, had switched gears, and they basically... the Greeks were different from every other empire because they did something to us that we had never experienced before with an enemy. Instead of crushing us, which was generally what happened, they opened up their arms. They said, we don't want to destroy Jewish culture. Now, maybe because Alexander the Great was, he was the son of a very open-minded emperor. He studied philosophy, Philo. Maybe because he was so young when he conquered the world. But his image was, I don't want to destroy you. I want to learn from you. I want to learn everything there is to know about your Jewish culture, and I'll share with you my Greek culture. So the stadiums weren't verboten to Jews. Jews were invited to join. And all of a sudden you had Greek rights and you could be a Greek citizen. It was tremendous. So for 100 years, the rabbis didn't know how to deal with this. Because they were used to an enemy. All of a sudden you could become Greeker than the Greeks. And so Jewish kids started leaving the yeshivas and going to the gymnasiums. Sound familiar? Around about the year 170, 175 before the Common Era, a fellow by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, Epiphanes basically means I am God, kind of gives you an insight into his character, he didn't think this was working. Jews were just not becoming Greek enough for him. So he switched it around, let's work with the old traditional way of doing things, and he started a series of edicts. The Greeks believed in the beauty of nature, worship of nature, the worship of the power of nature, the beauty of nature. The higher up in the natural order something was, the more it was to be worshipped. And therefore, of course, the highest level in nature was the human being. They worshipped the human body. And that's why in Greek history, in Greek mythology, the gods had human form, the gymnasium, sports, athletics. What decree do you think was the first Greek decree? What was the first Jewish mitzvah that was anathema to Greece that they said had to go? Nope. Brit Milah. Circumcision was an affront to everything Greek. Became forbidden to circumcise your son on pain of death. Okay? Shabbat. It was forbidden to worship Shabbat, to keep Shabbat. Kashrut. All these things. Eventually the Jews revolted against Greece. During that period of time, during the Hasmonean revolt against the Greeks, okay, one of the places where they built a fortress was on top of this mountain. Now we have no evidence of this fortress. We know of it from Sefer Maccabim, the book of the Maccabees, and we know of it because Josephus mentions it. But other than that, we have no evidence. We found no Maccabean evidence at Babsari yet. Okay? We may yet find it because 60% of this mountain has not yet been excavated. Right? But we haven't found it yet. In any event, about 100 years later, Herod, Hordus, comes to this mountain. Remember that he's a paranoiac. He's a king at the end of the Second Temple period. And he builds a fortress here. It's an incredible fortress. He's a master builder. He has brilliant architects. You'd be amazed at what we find up there. Okay? Herod himself used to come here in the summertime, in the wintertime, because the winter down here is beautiful. His Herod is built on the northern side of the hill, facing north, because that's the side of the hill that has the least amount of sun, in case he ever gets stuck here in the summer. Herod himself never climbs the snake path. He is carried up the snake path in a divan. If you're going to go, that's the way to go. That's the first official manhole cable car. We are not going to spend a lot of time on King Herod and his architecture and the way he builds, even though most tour groups do that. Because frankly, you can read about it in a book and visit it on your own. It's not really what you need me for. What fascinates me is the Jewish history, the perspective of what's going on here. What's important about the fact that Herod built it was that because Herod was such a paranoiac, so he left huge amounts of supplies here. So they find, yeah?
Were we under Greek rule?
Were we under, no, this is already Roman. Herod is a vassal of Rome. You're talking about 40, about 80 before the Common Era is when Rome becomes the bully on the block. Anyway, they built storehouses here. I'm going to show them to you. They built like 30 such storehouses. The climate here is so dry that everything survives. As a matter of fact, when Yigal Yadin brought his volunteers up on the mountain here, this is now in the 1960s, they found storehouses with material still in them, and they found food. They found dried dates, pomegranates, and some figs. And one of the college students on a dare, okay, took a bite out of one of the figs. This is a 2,000-year-old fig. And he ate it. It was edible. Because it was so preserved by the dry heat that's up here. So imagine that it's the year 71. Okay? And the temple has fallen. And these Jews are hiding out and coming through the desert. And eventually about 200 of them decide they need a safe haven. They know there's a Roman garrison up on top of the hill here. But this Roman garrison was basically a lookout point. It was basically to look eastwards towards what's today Jordan, the rest of the empire, and just, you know, keep an eye out. And their job was just, if you see an army coming across the valley, you know, send word to headquarters. Pretty easy job, right? You do your service, you sit for 3 years, no army's coming, life is good. There were about 30 Romans up here. In fact, some of them had their families here. Some of them had actually married Kutite women, Edomites, even one Jew. So the Jews came up on top of the mountain. And remember, it's not like today. It's like, imagine the equivalent is you're in the wilderness of Siberia or northern Alaska, the Arctic Circle. And you take over a little position and like, you know, there's no one else around for 1,000 miles. That's the equivalent. So they come up the snake path at dawn. They overpower the Romans that are up here and they basically give them a choice. Say, look, we didn't come up here to kill you, right? And you can stay with us. We're going to build a community here. Or you can leave. So Roman soldiers get a little nervous about hanging out with Jewish zealots. They opt to leave. They leave. That's all we know about them. I imagine that they probably sent word back to Rome. Now, for Rome, it probably wasn't worth it. So a bunch of Jewish idiots, after we've conquered their thing, let them starve to death. Leave them there. It doesn't become important. You know, nobody knows about it. Gradually, sort of, people hear rumors that there's a place that Jews have that's safe. And by the end, by the year 71, 72, there are 960 Jews that are up on top of the mountain here. Now the big question is, why did Rome care about these Jews? I mean, they ended up sending 3 full legions. 15,000 men. So why did Rome care? So imagine that you're a Jew, and you're a zealot, you're a fighter. Maybe you came out of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. Right? And you're now up on top of a Roman position. Like you're living in a Nazi SS base. And around you Your brothers and sisters are being sold into slavery. And what a slavery. I mean, you know, we're not talking about like American incarceration. The Romans went into battle, they put the heads of their enemies on the edges of their spears. They were barbarians, you know. On rare occasions, Jewish women who were captured were not raped because there was a special commodity of Jewish slaves that were virgins. Other than that, if you captured her, as long as you gave her in alive, you could do what you wanted with her. Most of the Roman soldiers in this part of the world were mercenaries. They were doing it for money. It's the lowest form of soldier. There's no idealism here. You know? So they were terrified about falling into Roman hands on the one hand, but they were thinking about all their cousins and their brothers and their sisters, their people. Could you sit up here? Add to that the fact that when they got up here, in addition to huge storehouses of food, they also found huge storehouses of weapons. Arrowheads and arrows and ballistica and bows and slingshots, whatever spears, because Herod was a paranoid. And all of Herod's stores had survived long after Herod was removed from power. So now you've got this problem. So they decided that they would start hitting Roman patrols. Maybe save a few Jews. And so they started coming out of the mountain at night and ambushing Roman patrols, and eventually word got back to Rome. Now, that still doesn't explain why the Romans came down here in such force. So there's some Jews fighting Roman patrols. Send a couple of patrols down. I'll tell you what the problem was. The problem is very simple. You see, this story was much bigger than just this story. Okay? In the year 70, when the Jewish temple was destroyed, right? So one of the things that Titus, who was the general that destroyed Jerusalem, did was he took 10,000 Jewish slaves on a victory march back to Rome. In fact, I think I mentioned this, they actually made an arch in his honor. If you go to Rome, you can see it. It's called the Arch of Titus. And in the bas-reliefs at the top of this arch, you can see very clearly a picture of Jewish slaves, right, that are being taken into captivity in Rome, right? And you can see the menorah very clearly. Okay? This is an image of Jewish slaves. This arch marked the victory of Rome over Judea. In fact, there were rabbis, medieval rabbis, Rishonim, the times of the Ramban and earlier Rashi, who said that it was forbidden for a Jew to walk underneath this arch because it was a symbol of Roman victory. Right? So the Romans had declared to the world that they had won this war. Not only that, you know, back then, they didn't have newspapers, right? So how did you spread the word? How did you let people know something if you wanted them to know it? You did something a little different. Anybody want to guess? Nope. You minted a coin. Okay? There was a special coin that was minted in the honor of the end of the Great Revolt. By the way, you know why this revolt was called the Great Revolt? It was called the Great Revolt by Rome. Because it had taken them 3 years to put it down. And they couldn't let the world know that it was such an insignificant number of people. So they called it the Great Revolt. This was the greatest revolt. It took us 3 years. But look what Rome did. We crushed them in our might. Take a look at the world map. Look at the numbers of Roman legionaries, the countries that they conquered. And realize that the Jews held them off for 3 years. That's unbelievable. So they printed a coin. You can see a picture of a Roman legionnaire. And he's standing next to a cowering woman, which represents the Jewish people. And this coin is actually called, it's minted, Judea Capta. Judea has been captured. The Jews have fallen. The barbarian monotheists, the pariahs, have been taken. So they have declared to the world that they won. Now comes a small group of Jews, and they decide, you know, the war isn't over yet. And they start fighting Roman soldiers. If news spreads that there's still a war on, that the war hasn't been won, this could be disastrous. If other peoples get wind of the fact that Jews are still rebelling against Rome, right? This could spread across the whole empire. Very dangerous. So they have to crush this. So what do? They send first two and then a third full legion. Now what's a legion? I want to give you an image of what it is. Okay, you wake up one morning, you're 960 men, women, and children. You're on top of this mountain. And one day you look down, okay? And they understood psychological warfare. They wanted you to see the array of forces. So one day you look down. This isn't even the whole picture, okay? You're only seeing about 80% of one legion here. This is what one legion looked like from up on top of the mountain. Okay? That's one legion. Now imagine, and it's bigger than this, because this is about 80% of it, because they cropped the picture. Imagine that there are three of these, and they're down around the mountain. And you understand the dedication and the determination of the Romans to finish off the Jews. Okay? A legion was about 5,000 men. Usually there were about 1,000 to 1,500 fighters, support personnel. There were the actual Roman legions, and there were the auxiliaries, the expeditionaries. I'll spare you all the strategic technical details. Okay? This is one legion. Oui, legion. Right? So now you're a Jew, and you're sitting up on top of the mountain, and you're surrounded by three Roman legions. And that is the beginning of this story. And Josephus writes about this story, and he documents it from start to finish. How it began, and how it ended. I'll tell you one more thing. We're about to get on the cable car, but I'll tell you one more thing. When we go up this cable car, take a look at two things. First of all, just as an aside, to the left here, you'll see a natural valley. It is very clear to be able to see how a flash flood have once came through here. Okay? You'll see the boulders strewn about. We'll talk about that at En Gedi. Also want you to notice, you see this wall, these thick walls in back of me? Okay? When we get to the top of the mountain, I'm going to show you three different encampments. You can see them very clearly off the top of the mountain. This is one of them. It's right near the base of the cable car. You'll be able to see it up below. This was the Roman command center. Okay, this is the Roman command center. There were three different camps. The reason there are three different camps is because the Romans did not trust their own soldiers. They were the Roman soldiers and the officers. And then there were the mercenaries. And they were afraid that the mercenaries would eventually, you know, just overpower them. How do you keep mercenaries down here? You pay them. Well, so in order to pay them, you have to have the treasure, right, to pay them with, the money. Because what if a mercenary decides to leave? Right? And they paid them a fortune. So they were always afraid the mercenaries would overcome them. And so, because they were afraid the Romans would overcome them, they built separate camps. Roman guards patrolled the mercenary camps so that they wouldn't rise up in the night and overcome their Roman captors. Now, the Zealots had fought the Romans, and they knew this. And so when they saw the separate camps, that gave them hope. So notice this camp as we go up over it. And the last thing I want to point out to you, does this bother you if I'm speaking? No, right? The last thing that's worth noticing, when you go up the snake camp, imagine that you are a Roman legion. And you're commanded by a general by the name of Da Silva. Okay, a Roman, an Italian, right? And you get to this fortress, and you've got 5,000 men. And there's a couple hundred fighters. By the way, does that sound familiar, those numbers? Right? Old city, Jordanian legion, same pattern, same story, just different episode, right? So now you're Da Silva, and you come to the foot of the mountain. He said, this is no problem, because we got a path. So we're going to take this path up the mountain. We'll take our trained Roman legion, and we'll just hip up the mountain and take these guys over. Okay, so 5,000 men begin to climb the snake path, which you can see right behind us. Okay, and things go well until they reach almost the top. And you look from here, you can see there's like a sort of a cliff outcropping before the, just below the cable car. Do you see that? It looks like a building. Okay? So when we see it from the top, you'll see it very clearly. And the way you read Josephus, it seems that that's where this occurs. Okay? The Jews saw them coming. They saw them coming for days. They saw the dust cloud in the distance. They watched them set up their camp. And eventually they watched them come up the mountain. Their commander was a fellow of Elazar ben Yair. Elazar ben Yair had a lot of experience because he fought with the rebels in the north. He knew Roman tactics. He was brilliant. So he figured, okay, no problem. So he waits till he gets to the top. You saw those ballistica that I showed you before, the slingshots? Okay, I'm going to show you up top. They have huge boulders. They found them in piles at the top of the snake path and the other path on the other side. And Josephus described this. They had huge boulders. So what do you do? What's the problem with mountain warfare? I learned this in the Israeli army. The problem with mountain warfare, the reason it's so dangerous, is because in the mountains, by definition, you have narrow roads and passes that you go on a line. So if you're commanding a company of tanks and you're out in an open field, that's great. You give me an open field, put me up against any Syrian company in the world, each tank, 52 tons, 105 millimeter cannons, three full machine guns. But if you're all in a row, only the front guy gets to fire. You can't fire through the guy in front of you. It's exactly the problem this Roman column had. Remember that street that I showed you that was built like this? Same thing. So what did they do? They waited until they got almost to the top, 30 yards to the top, and they just started rolling these boulders down the snake path. And Josephus describes, this is how we know, this is true, I'm not making this up, they were scattered like nine pins. They had a game similar to bowling, which was called pins. And they just bowled for Romans. And they knocked these guys, went flying off the sides of the hills, right? And you'll see as we ride over, if you're on the snake path and you get sent flying off the edge, you're done. You're done. Not only are you done, but your screams carry all the way down. De Silva tried this twice. He tried to surprise them the second time in the morning, and they had the same thing happen. And so all of a sudden, then he could hear the cheers of the Jews up above. This is an impregnable fortress. They had enough food supply that they think for 30 years. So the Jews on top were not whistling Dixie. There are only two real approaches to the top of this mountain, and they're both similar. And that's where our story takes us, and we're going to see the rest up top. The reason there's no air conditioning, by the way, on the cable car is to prepare you for Masada. Okay? It's not because technologically we're challenged. Josephus was here. He was here. He was brought down. He was, you have to understand, he was one of the rebel generals. So he knew how the rebels fought. And he doesn't write this, but they brought him down. Because they were, they didn't think they needed him. All of a sudden they realized they got rebels up here who know tactics. They brought him down with this third legion so that he could, that's the big question. Is he a hero or a villain?
What was his Hebrew name?
But this is after Jerusalem. This is in the year 72. What? Yeah. Yeah, you got to read his books, Yosef ben Matityahu. He has two books, Wars and Antiquities, The Wars of the Jews and Antiquities. Incredible books. I mean, yeah, I can show you one in Israelite. I have one in the office. Yeah, I've read that through. Take a look. You can see the Roman command center on your right down below you. See that? You see how there's one entrance only? They guarded them very close. This is probably, at least at the beginning, where De Silva was. And if you look on your left, you can actually see the sort of the path of one of the flash floods that came down here not long ago. You see that little booth on the right there? You see that little space where you could sit in the shade? That's called the Neberstop. This cable car? This cable, the one we're in now is new. The one we're in now is only about 5 years ago. Oh, the first cable car? I think, don't quote me on this, I think the first cable car built was actually built in Switzerland. I think it's called the first, F-U-R-S-T, but also the first in English. And it goes up to the Klein Schneider to the, what's it called, the Jungfrau.
This is, so, in other words, this cable car...
The first cable car here was built in the early 70s. But it only held 40 people. It occasionally broke down.
Here in the early 70s, it was a cable car. We had no choice during the war.
Oh, yes, maybe it was later. I know by the end of the 70s, they definitely had a cable car.
Okay. It was 73.
So it was probably after the Yom Kippur War. Okay. Maybe with the reparations. Okay, look on the side to your left, and you will actually see one of the water canals.
No, I went up and just talked about it. How did they get water? In Masada.
One of the big questions is how they got water. So we will talk about that later.
That is cool how they got water.
You can actually see one of the water canals that carried water up here under the bridge. We're not going to go down there, but... And you can see one of the that little cave that's down there, that was one of the places where water was stored. So we'll talk about that in a little while.
Food was dehydrated.
Pardon?
Food was dehydrated,
right? Right, it was all dry.
Thank you.
Yeah, no cholent up here. Okay, Israelite... Come walk with me over here to the side for a second. You guys are welcome to hang with us if you want. Now, later, anytime. Anytime. All right. Israelite, wait here for one sec, just so we'll let this group go ahead. All right. So here's what I want you to do before we move forward, okay? Walk over to the fence. Walk over to the fence. First of all, did everybody say Todah? It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. All right. Look down below you, and you will see three very distinct squares. Okay? Three very distinct squares. The first square, which is the thickest, it's the best preserved, the nicest looking, is at the base of the cable car, the one that I showed you from below. Do you see that? Okay, that is the command center. Okay? Now, if you look to the left, okay, and behind it, you'll see two more. There's one that's closer to us, okay, and that was the auxiliary. Those are the fighters. That was the camp of the people who were going to come up here and tear us to bits. In the rear, sort of in the middle, Kilo, there's three. One is back, if you picture a triangle, the top of the triangle, in the back there, towards the trees. That big square was the main base camp of the Romans. You got it so far?
Yep.
Okay. By the time they were finished, they think this was the first camp that was set up. They had eight such camps around the mountain.
Wow.
Eight. You got it? Eight camps like that. Gives you an idea of the array of forces that were here. Okay? All right, come. We're going to head up the mountain. Come. Now, by the way, notice this. See that? That shows you that this is an ongoing excavation.
Oh, wow.
And that's how they do it. They plug it into the side of the mountain, and they work. Here, come on in here and sit down. Take a look. You'll see that this is an ongoing excavation. They're actually working on this side of the hill for reasons that will become apparent later. Come on inside and sit down. Okay? If you look over here, you'll see that this is an ongoing excavation. All right, you see the scaffolding? They hang over the side of the cliff. It looks easy from here. Let me tell you, it's a frightening experience. Come. Come grab a seat. All right, this is the entrance to Masada. There are only two entrances to Masada. Now imagine that you get this far, and maybe you're even coming to visit King Herod. Okay, King Herod's palace is up this way, and where the zealots were is down this way. Okay? And you come up here, you actually make it up the snake path. Okay? Because there are guard positions below in the time of Herod. Now you gotta come through here. This is like a little mini fortress. This is where the guard sat. You can see the original stone. Herod built not just a fortress, he built a palace. The luxury here is unbelievable. Okay, we're not going to get to see it in its entirety. You'll get a taste of it. Herod knew how to live the good life. Okay? And this was like, you know, you and me, Joe Chinook comes here, there's two guards here. Say, well, do you have an invitation? Like, who are you? And if you can't show that you have a reason to be here, right, then you're not coming in. Goodbye, back to the desert, right? And always amazes me to think, you know, these were soldiers defending a Roman tyrant, a Jewish puppet, from Jews. This was a fortress where Jews held off Roman legionnaires. And today, in a modern state of Israel, we're coming up here to see a piece of our past. And we're walking over the remnants, the dust of Roman history. Right? Come. You can read that sign if you want, and then follow me. I do want to point out that you will on occasion see these types of things. Okay? They have only excavated about 40% of this mountain. Look at the open space that isn't excavated. Okay, for example, that whole open plain there, that's how we found it. You know, 30, 40 years ago. And it's an ongoing excavation site, which obviously depends on funding and other things. There are a few things you should know. First of all, you're not allowed to smoke up here. You're not allowed to eat food up here. So if you brought food up, just save it for later. You're not allowed to walk underneath one of these walls, which I think is an amazing thing because we're uncovering our history. And I say this not just out of interest, but because if you step under one of these walls and one of those fellows, where did he just go? You'll see these guys with these jackets. They're the official, the wardens, the rangers up here. They will give me a $500 fine, okay, if I stand on an excavation, things like that, which I am very happy about because I think it's how we preserve the site. There are the largest single recorded year of tourists up in Masada was 1.7 million people who visited in a year. Okay? It's obviously dropped a lot down now. And July is not a big month for Masada only because it's very hot. But Passover, for example, this whole mountain is full of people. That's why they have to institute these laws. Come, I want to show you something amazing. Come. Now, by the way, because that's when the Christian tourists come. By the way, take a look at something. It's a question mark for you. Back there is the palace of King Herod. You're going to see very clearly in the palace of King Herod, okay, that it was a luxurious place. Now, when the Zealots came up here, 960 of them, that palace was empty. So why didn't they live up there? Instead, they built all these homes here. These are called the casement walls. And they built these. These were built about 120 years after Herod's palace. We know, and I'll explain later when we're in the shade, that they were built by Zealots. One of the questions is why they bothered. It's a tremendous amount of work. Why they bothered to build these things? File that away. Come. I want everybody to drink. Take a drink. Yeah, Herod lived, his heyday was like 30 to 40 before the Common Era. And the Jews got here in the year 71. That's like the difference between when I was born and Abraham Lincoln. There was a Roman garrison up here. They didn't all know it was here. There ended up being a couple hundred families that knew it was here.
It was kind of vacated at the time.
They vacated it. They found a Roman garrison up here and they overpowered them and they kicked them off the mountain. Right, this was a home. Do not stand on those walls. You cannot stand on those walls. That's an art. I want you to understand something. And groups do this, and it's just something to be aware of. And it's okay, because everybody makes the same mistake. That is a 2,000-year-old wall. That wall was built by Jews who came up here determined that the Jewish people should not be defeated. That even though Jerusalem was destroyed, the Jewish armies were destroyed, that if there's a group of Jews living as Jews in the land of Israel, then Rome has not won. And in their quest to do that, they build a city up here. And this is part of that city. So don't stand on a 2,000-year-old piece of archaeological history, because here it could crumble. That'd be a nasty feeling. But anyway, so this is a home that they built. You can see that this was a family home, because it has three rooms and an entrance place. That's one room. That's another room. This is a third room. Anybody want to guess what this room was for?
Cooking.
Wow, you see the stove?
Mm-hmm.
That's a stove. That's actually a stove that's described in the Talmud. Okay? You can read about that type of stove, okay, in the Talmud, and it's amazing that you're learning something in the Gemara, and then you actually see how they built it. But that isn't why I brought you here. I brought you here because of what they found in the dirt, exactly where Andy is standing. Okay? And you can read about this in Yigal Yadin. They had a theory. Do you notice how this house is built out?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, they found a few strange things here. They found things that they didn't expect to find. They found a couple of weapons. And it was like a strange place to store your weapons. Like, why were they left here, right? So they had a theory that this would have been a natural place to put a guard position, right? I mean, if you look below, you can see the Roman camps. When we're sitting in the shade, I'm going to tell you the story of how the Romans tried again and again to break their way up here. And the Jews were very alert, and there was a constant watch on what the Romans were doing so that they could be prepared for them if they tried to sneak up the snake path and things like that. So they had a guard here. Okay? The most incredible find, maybe there are two, but this is my personal favorite, that was made up here in the Sadeh in the 8 years of the original excavation, was that they found a little piece of scroll in the ground. It was one of the scrolls that Professor Nitzer was talking about in the film. You don't just pull a scroll out of the ground and open it up, right? I mean, you destroy it that way. It's the whole process of brushing it and putting the right liquids on it and moistening it so that you can open it. When they eventually get it open, they discover in Hebrew, the same Hebrew that I speak to my children, or don't actually, but the same Hebrew my children speak to each other, they found the 82nd chapter of Tehillim of the Psalms. And I was thinking about, why was there one chapter of Tehillim here? And I'll tell you why I think that was. And I remember once on my way up to Lebanon. Okay, by the way, you want to hear a freaky thing while I'm telling you this story? There is a legend. It's one of the few legends common to the Bedouin, the Druze, and the Jews. There's a legend that actually comes from the Kabbalah. I have no idea what to do with this. And I used to think it was nonsense until I came up Masada. And that is that souls can come back and be reincarnated as different things, as animals. Called a Gilgal, a reincarnation, right? Just because your body ends doesn't mean your soul ends. Your soul is on a journey. You know, I might have been something else in the last life, etc. In fact, there are whole explanations. We could talk about this when we're on the air-conditioned bus later. Whole explanations about why different people have different personalities. Why was I born with a happy spirit and some people are born with an intense spirit? Well, because maybe I'm descended from a Hasidic Rebbe and someone else is descended from a Holocaust survivor. Who knows? I don't mean descended. I mean reincarnated. I've read these things, they fascinate me, I have no idea what to do with them. They don't really change the way I relate to Judaism and to God, but there are some incredible stories that it's at least worth having a healthy respect. Anyway, so I once read a sefer that was so weird, a book, that I just put it down in the middle. I said, you know, this is too freaky, I'm not ready for this stuff. Yeah. I was talking about reincarnations and how you find your mystical path and whatever. One of the things in there that it said is that souls that suffer when they die come back as birds. Now that was weird. And the weirdest thing was, okay, that the bird in Kabbalah that's associated with the suffering soul that is looking for its eternal resting place, that is waiting for the suffering they went through to have meaning, why don't they guess? Ravens. Okay? Now weird blackbirds. So the Bedouin claimed that these are the souls of the people that died here. Now I don't know what you do with that, and maybe that's just woo, but something to think about. Right, yeah. Well, if I opened up a Gemara, you'd see that all come land here, but I don't want to freak you out, so I won't do that. But anyway, no, that's the soul. The airplanes are the souls of lost communities. It's different. Anyway, I interrupted my own story. I'm good at that. Anyway, so when I was on my way up to Lebanon one time, this is a common occurrence. I don't know an Israeli soldier hasn't had this experience. We used to have to go to Yad Eliyahu, which is a stadium outside of the bus station in Tel Aviv. And that's where all the buses would come. You know, when we were at war with Lebanon, there were thousands and thousands of soldiers who would be off on leave, and they would have to go up to Lebanon every Sunday. Right? So you'd get a weekend pass. And so you'd go, and you would find your unit, and you would get on your bus, and you would head to your base. Right? And, you know, you would walk from the central bus station to Yad Eliyahu. It was like a 10-minute walk. And you had all your gear on you. Now, when you see soldiers today walking around, they're walking on dress uniforms. They've got maybe a gun with them in a bag. But when you came down from Lebanon, it wasn't safe until you got over the border. So you had to leave your base with all your gear, with your efod, your flak vest, and your shrapnel vest, and your cartridges, and your gear, and your helmet, and your webbing, and everything. So you looked like somebody who's in the middle of combat, and then you would sort of, you know, get a ride or catch a bus, and you'd walk around in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and you'd feel like an idiot, you know. But everybody knew who the combat soldiers were, right? Because if you saw a guy with all this gear, you knew that he was coming from Lebanon. That's just what it was. So it's kind of like a mark of pride, right? And so one time I'm walking on a Sunday morning to catch my bus back at 11, and I got all my gear with me. And this woman, right, is a beggar, okay? And she's begging me for money. And I passed by, I didn't really have any money on me, and I said, you know, tada, right? Nothing. And I keep walking, and she gets up and starts walking after me, right? And I'm like, look, but Emily, I feel bad. I really don't have any money on me. I'm like, you know, I'm going up to 11, and I bring my wallet with me, you know, who needs it, right? And so she won't let me go, and she takes out. Now, you know, beggars like to give you something for what they get, so that they feel like it's an exchange instead of tzedakah, and I understand that. So they used to give out these little plastic-covered Tehillim, books of Psalms. You ever see these little tiny Tehillim books that are in plastic casing, right? And they would give them to you if you gave them tzedakah. That was like their way of whatever. So she wants to give me this thing, and I still think she wants tzedakah, right? And she says, Lolo, tikach motek. Take this, you know. Hashem should protect you and guard you and keep you safe. And then I remember that there's a line in the Talmud that says, tzedakah tatzil mimavet, that tzedakah saves you from death. Now, if you're a soldier, you're going up to Lebanon, and a beggar woman wants to give you a book of Psalms, you take it, right? So I found a shekel, and I gave her a shekel, and I kept it. And I kept it in my breast pocket, and it still sits in my uniform. This is like, what, I don't know, 25, 20 years later. And I take it with me every time I go to reserve duty and every time I go on patrol. And a few times I can think of where I opened it up, and it came in handy in extreme situations. And I think that's why they found that psalm here. Because if you're a guard, and you're doing duty in the year 71, and the mightiest empire on the face of the earth has brought 3 legions to surround you, and you say to yourself, this is crazy, there's like no hope. But then you remember that we've got this secret recipe. So you pull out your book of Tehillim, and you read the psalm. 2,000 years ago, a Jewish soldier, just like I did, saying Tehillim here, looking down at the Roman army. And what's the Tehillim that he chose to say? The text of this is amazing. First of all, it's the text that we still say in the army today. Okay, which I always thought was just something somebody came up with. Okay, which is how I know it. Elokim Nitzav Badat Kel. God, the God of judgment, stands amongst the congregation of God. Ad matai tishpetu avel ufnei rasha'im tisusela. How long until you judge iniquity? How long will you countenance the wicked? When will justice prevail? That's the text of this psalm. And I can understand a soldier whose language was Hebrew, so this was his spoken language, looking down at the long ages and saying this. That was his question. It took 2,000 years for us to be able to not give, but to be the answer. We are the answer. You get it? Okay.
Is that I am Biz?
Paybet. 82. Come. Come follow me, guys. Now we're going to go up to Herod's palace. Okay, here's another oven. Another cooking area. See if you can guess why they might have two ovens. The most amazing thing is up there you can see Mrs. Zutt.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.